This is the Digressio podcast of Roman Roads Press, helping Christian families inherit the humanities. I'm Cooper Salmon. I do video and marketing, and I'm here with Daniel Fukushan, the founder of Roman Roads.
Glad to be here.
And today we're going to be talking about our motto, Roman Roads motto, inherit the humanities, which is something we came up with kind of a couple of years ago that really captures a lot of what Roman Roads is about. But we realized in a discussion a couple weeks ago, there's really a lot there. There's a lot to unpack. So what does, Daniel, what does inherit the humanities mean?
Well, inherit the humanities is what I think is a great explanation for what is a classical education. So over the last 5 to 6 years, as we have been traveling to homeschool conventions, talking to a lot of different classical educators, I've made a point of asking every educator that I could what a classical education is. And I started this because I wanted an answer for myself. I didn't have a clear, concise answer. And I was amazed to see the breadth of answers. I rarely got the same answer. And there's, of course, a lot of overlap. And I think that that's on purpose because of the nature of, I think we'll unpack that a little bit, but the nature of a classical education of the humanities of means that you can't just, it's not something new that you can perfectly define. I was not very satisfied with most of the answers. A lot of, let me actually kind of walk you through some of the answers I've gotten, I've received.
And these are from the people who are kind of at the top of the classical education world, the leaders in classical education that you've been asking?
Yeah. People like, some of the people who have written books, about it, Doug Wilson, Wes Callahan, Andrew Poudois, Andrew Kern, Martin Cothran. There's just a few of the names that come to mind, but these are leaders in classical education.
Exactly the sort of people that you would want to hear. What is classical education exactly? What are some of the answers that you got?
Right. So I remember the one that intrigued me the most was actually Wes Callahan, who said that classical education is an education in Latin and Greek. And I was like, wait, what? Latin and Greek. So if you don't know Latin and Greek, and of course you have to unpack all of these. So what he meant by that is the tradition passed down to us in the great books that were the tradition of the Latin and Greek texts.
Just the languages.
Although he would definitely stress an importance on the language in learning it and everything that comes with learning it, including the ability to read some of the original texts. And I would say that the definitions often divide into two camps, a pedagogical approach and a more historical content approach.
So what you're learning versus how you learn.
Right. And so a lot of people, especially in the ACCS world, the Association of Classical Christian Schools, world will tend to associate the pedagogy that comes from they think of classical education and they think of the Trivium. The Trivium was developed by Dorothy Sayers not that long ago. She wrote a book called The Lost Tools of Learning, which was then revived with Doug Wilson's Recovering the Lost Tools of Learning. And it is a pedagogy approach that we now often associate with classical education. And I don't think it's the best explanation to say what is classical education. It's good. It's useful. The stages of learning of the Trivium are useful to are a useful tool, but it's ultimately a new take, a new innovation, some good observations of human nature and basing it off of there was the Trivium and the Quadrivium in the Middle Ages and that does apply well to the high school years in particular. Basically second through 12th grade is where that's most often applied. Another common definition is that I appreciate a lot is the that put out by the Searcy Institute, which is cultivating wisdom and virtue. Classical education is an education that is a cultivation of wisdom and virtue. And I think that's a very good working definition of a classical education.
Interesting. So classical education is
the cultivation of wisdom and virtue.
That's an interesting take.
Yeah. Huh. And that has a, I would be in that direction. That has a, somewhat of a pedagogical lean, but also a content, you know, you're leaning onto content and, pedagogy. It's definitely, oriented towards the student and not the results or practicality of such an education, but you know, it's
like
about
spiritual development.
It's about the person. Student.
Interesting. Well, that's, and that is the, you would say that that is their take on the answer to the question, what is classical education?
Mm-hmm. That's their motto as well.
That's very, very pedagogical direction, the telos of the education, what's the end, and very far for like, you know, because I could, okay, that's an interesting take, which we might dig into more, but maybe you're...
Yeah, so that goes to the purpose of education and less of the how. So I'd like to propose not a competing, not a they're wrong and I'm right, but a an additional view of or answer to what is classical education. In what has become our motto, our phrase, inherit the humanities. And what I appreciate about that is that there's often the question of what is the humanities? You know, what should we be studying? Many people look at classical education and they're like, well, who says we should be studying that? And what if I'm Chinese? Should I be studying these Western guys? You know, these kinds of questions come. And I think there's a principle in that, if you unpack that phrase, that would apply to an alternate universe even. You know, if there was no Aristotle or Plato, you could still take this definition with you. So inherit the humanities is a verb to, you know, it's an imperative, inherit, but it points at, and then to the object, humanities, it points to where the source is. So if you have an inheritance, it's something that is your birthright. You know, it's something that you have to receive. It's not something you passively receive. You have to step into it. You have to sign the papers. You have to take possession. So there. I like that imagery there, which is, I think, very appropriate for education. It's it is an active thing, and it tells you about. It tells you about where you should look for it. So there might be things of good value. If we have a great books list, and it's a valid question to say, well, why isn't this thing over here is very good? Why isn't it on it? Mm-hmm. And ultimately, it comes down to, is this part of your inheritance? Is this the most important thing in your inheritance? And so, in the context of inheritance, I would like to show that the books we generally choose is not the perfect. It also shows that a great books list isn't some. It's not the Bible. You know, it's not divinely inspired. Right. There is room for arguing. Yeah. There's not a canon, correct? But so there is room for saying, hey, this should be included. Our great books list has a few omissions and a few things that maybe should be moved around. And you know, maybe our great grandkids will be modifying it a bit. You know, there is some room for that. But if you have a rubric for it. I inherit the humanities. That definition of classical education gives a framework for why we chose the books we did choose to include in our canon, lower C, in our list of the great books and of how we approach classical education as a whole. And so I actually would like to kind of go in that direction of doing a short defense of why. Of basically putting that definition to the task, putting it to use.
Okay, interesting. So you would say that your take on that this question, what is classical education? You would say that classical education is inheriting the humanities. I'm interested. I don't think I've ever heard you actually put it that way and connect the motto to this question of what is classical education. I'm interested, unless you want to take this a different direction, if you don't mind my digging into that a little bit.
Yeah. Go
so,
ahead.
So the two camps, how we learn pedagogical versus content, which right. is what you're studying. That seems to be very much in the camp of what you're studying, the content, mm-hmm. the humanities, which in the very definition of that word seems to limit or at least emphasize, if not limit it to great books and philosophy and literature. It certainly puts a great deal of emphasis on those, the great, like the, that subject, that topic.
Right.
Do you think that there's a pedagogical element to your definition of classical education?
Well, I think those are maybe slightly two different questions, but the, okay. the, so inherit the humanities, part of how I would define the humanities is those, the knowledge, that has been valued, stood the test of time and handed down to us.
Okay.
Which is an interdisciplinary, approach. So,
okay.
But it also, if the handed down is important. We publish calculus mm-hmm. and, our approach to calculus embodies the inherit the humanities motto. Mitch Stokes, the author of our calculus texts, says the history of math is math. How do we as classical educators come to calculus? We come to calculus by saying, what is our inheritance? It's how we understand science and math and the STEM fields, the traditional humanities fields, the great books. It's an integrated approach that does not say calculus, physics live in a vacuum. They are truth in you know, by themselves. They're embodied in inheritance. They're embodied in history. They're embodied in how we have gotten them. And so the pedagogy attached is that you can't understand a subject without understanding where it came from. You can't just say, you know, you don't have a lawyer say, hey, this is yours. Why? Well, your great aunt Susie, who you've never heard of, like it's yours because, you know, and it's part of understanding that context. You know, the inheritance assumes that lineage, that connection, of where you're getting it and why you're getting it. And so, the way we approach our subjects is not just here's what you must learn, and it's valuable because we say so, or it's valuable because, you know, insert any reason other than connecting it back. So it's rooted. It's rooted in history. So calculus, we start calculus. Mitch Stokes's text starts with the Greeks. You know, you're learning about Plato and Aristotle in the first chapter, and you really are doing calculus. And he I've in conversations with him, he's talked about how he'll quote a famous physicist who says that string theory has been stuck for the past 30 years or so because we have a generation or two of scientists who haven't inherited the humanities, who don't have that interdisciplinary approach to subjects. Mm-hmm. And so they're unable to understand some of these very advanced aspects of their fields, and especially as it relates to other disciplines, because they are viewing it in isolation. They're really good at what they do, but they don't understand, like you would say, that the history of math is math. You know, it's absolutely essential to understanding. So it does affect pedagogy, and that's where the more I think about it, the more I think it fits. Inherit the humanities is the key to understanding the rubric of how we approach classical education and do classical education.
Okay. So that is an interesting direction. So what you mean by humanity, even by what you mean by humanities, is actually this broader interdisciplinary
right.
approach connecting all areas of study.
Right.
And even because calculus is a new form of math, you know, hasn't right. been around for very long. So you're saying that humanity, that it is part of the humanities, like right. math, right. hard math, STEM. is part of the humanities, according to this approach.
Calculus was developed by people who did have an interdisciplinary approach and who didn't view math as a separate field. Right. You know, if you're looking at the ancient Greeks, they certainly didn't separate these fields, right? So, math is a major part of the quadrivium, of course, and so there is. Liberal arts. Again, to quote Mitch Stokes, you know, he believes that the recent divorce in the Enlightenment between the humanities and the STEM fields is doing both a great disfavor. So his mission is to teach liberal arts students, you know, to traditionally view these things as separate, to truly integrate them. This definition fully embodies those fields that are often viewed as, oh, that's not humanities, is literature and poetry and, you know, the thing. No, it's also the beauty of math, you know, of including calculus.
Interesting.
And physics and all of the really all of the human nodes of knowledge, all the human humanities is you know, comes from the root human, related to human. It's human study, human knowledge. So there's really not much truly excluded.
Okay, interesting. So this view of the humanities is of this history, this philosophy as being kind of the core, that you're emphasizing the core of education, that philosophy and theology, what we would typically think of as more standard humanities, as connecting everything, even science and math are connected into a cohesive whole through the humanities. Is that kind of what you're saying? Is that an accurate way of trying to picture it? That all of these different studies that, you know, go in that we very typically think of as different realms of knowledge. Math doesn't have much overlap with poetry, most people right. would assume. So they're all connected.
Yeah, they're all connected. They shouldn't be treated as separate, individual, disconnected fields of study, but they're all interconnected. So one of the practical elements of this is, isn't that overwhelming? So what do you decide to teach? At least there's the relief of, if I'm a math major, if I'm a math guy, I can forget about all the poetry and just focus on the math. There's a little bit of that relief when you separate it out. And so if you have to study everything, that sounds very much like a generalist. So there's an integrated approach to specializing, that, you know, where you can, that's why it's so important to have certain foundations before you specialize, is actually the way to go about it. But to kind of back up a little bit, you know, if what do you decide to put in your curriculum? What do you decide to do? Especially if you're trying to integrate all this. And that's where I think the word inherit is so important. It doesn't place the stress on this objective, let's put this on the table, analyze it, and decide if it's good. And if it's good, it should be included. Rather, where does it come from? Who has it affected? How has it, are we standing on its shoulders?
I see.
And there can be good things that don't deserve our same attention. That's where that word inheritance, I think, is just helpful. It's like, well, is it part of our inheritance? Doesn't mean that something that's not isn't good, but it helps us divide and parse out what is and isn't good.
I see. So I,
or sorry, what isn't, shouldn't, should or shouldn't be included as essential to a curriculum.
Right, right. Where it comes from. So I guess the picture that suggests to me is inheriting these things that have come from, from past generations that have been passed down to us, as opposed to, that's like an inheritance, as opposed to just sort of winning the lottery. Like this thing, there's this thing, it's nice. It doesn't necessarily have a reason for coming to us, particularly as opposed to this thing that all of the great thinkers, great writers, great philosophers and theologians of the West have developed and been working on these ideas and these books and these works and passed that on to us. It's ours to inherit. It's not just something good out there that's impersonally, there's a personal connection to us as Americans, as people who, as Americans, as Christians, something for us to value.
Right. And so that would be a good segue too. You know, so so who are we here? You know, so we're Christians, we're in the West, and you know, our flagship product is old Western culture. It's like, and the, you know, we get the question. So is it only Western texts? What about others? So that's kind of answering that. And so I actually want to apply the motto a little bit, give it a field run a little bit. So we read in old Western culture, a lot of Greek and Roman, literature. It's, a lot of it feels very disconnected from us, at first glance. And there's, you know, there's a lot of different ways you can approach the this inheritance aspect. For example, you could look at our founding fathers and who we are as Americans and say, oh, they were greatly valued the Romans, which they did. And we could talk about that. But, as a Christian, so this is now going to appeal to more than just Americans, as a Christian and personally as the son of an evangelist, something I've, as a son of a pastor's son, something I've, come to realize as I've, learned more and grown more in my knowledge of classical education is how much the connection to from the Roman, the Greeks, and especially the Romans, the connection that they have to the gospel and to Christianity. So we could say a lot of people here, well, the early church fathers appreciated the Greeks, but it's much more fundamental than that. This is borrowing some of the work of my father, who whose doctorate of ministries thesis was on the evangelism of Europe in the 21st century and trying to understand the European mind. But the way we experience the gospel, think about the traditional sharing of the gospel. You know, when we explain the gospel, we go to Romans, Galatians, Ephesians, Colossians, Thessalonians. What are these?
Towns in the Roman Empire.
Exactly.
The people living
First of all, the book of Romans is straight to Rome.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've been to Ephesus and I've sat in the Roman Colosseum in Ephesus. You know, it was very Roman. And so when we generally as Americans, as Westerners, explain the gospel, we are using a Roman, the Apostle Paul's Roman terminology that he used to explain the gospel. And so there are a lot of ways that we can show how he actually even quoted the Romans, the Roman idea of a body, you know, so the church is a body. If one member hurts, they all hurt. You know, that's a Roman idea of a Roman colony. That's something that the Romans understood. That wasn't Paul inventing a metaphor. He was borrowing a metaphor. There's aspects of the Aeneid where, you know, Wes Callahan explains in old Western culture how, you know, the Old Testament had prophecy and the pagan nations had these longings, as he's quoting C.S. Lewis there. Jupiter's prophecy to Aeneas, saying that, you know, he would found a kingdom, a nation, world without end. And we hear, oh, wow, I recognize some terminology from the Apostle Paul. He's basically saying, you know, this is not the, it's, you know, you're right to long for these things, but it's the church, it's Christ, it's not Rome, it's not Caesar. So these were things so we understand the gospel in Roman terms. And it comes back to, you know, there's one gospel message, but there's three general ways that people experience the effects of sin and salvation. And as Americans, we have a very, very, like, most nations have more of a mix, but as Americans, we are very much a legal Roman understanding of and we experience the effects of sin and salvation from a very legal and Roman perspective.
Interesting.
We think of justification. What's salvation? It's a court scene. a Roman court scene where you are said you are, you know, the penalty is taken away. You're justified. You are made right. You are guilty versus not guilty. You know, we talk about the gospel in terms of if you were, you know, the two questions, you know, if you were to die tonight and find yourself before God, he said, why should I let you into heaven? I'm a good person. No, God's, you know, all these questions about surrounding foundations are very Roman, very legal based questions.
Interesting. And it was funny to me just a small tangent. It was funny to me, learning about other ways of thinking about salvation that had been so exclusively, especially as a Protestant, that had been almost exclusively the only way that I ever thought of salvation, as this metaphor, that metaphor of guilty in a court,
right,
or, of that, or as, owing a debt or something like right. that. Whereas, you know, other cultures like the Eastern Orthodox or the Old Testament will have different metaphors of being captured by Satan, or by the Old Testament talks about sin as a burden instead of a, you know, breaking of a law. But anyway, so,
right,
but
right.
we think of it in particular ways, and you're saying very Roman influenced right. ways.
So we're very Roman. The most, like you mentioned, most of the Eastern nations are have instead of a guilt innocence, it's a shame honor. So they experience the effects of sin, and all of this is very much present in the Bible. But we tend
and we emphasize certain parts because of our worldview, our outlook. Yeah.
So to be Muslim culture in particular, that's a very, very strong. They experience the effects of they'll read biblical passages that just pass us by, and for example, the parable of the prodigal son.
Oh yeah.
There are elements that there's a missionary who had to write under a pseudonym. I think it was Mueller was a pseudonym who unpacked some of these passages from a Muslim perspective. And I've, you know, read that parable many times, but he showed details that the father hiked up his
robe,
robe and ran towards his son and put a ring on his finger and fattened the slaughtered calf. And we're like, a party. And he's thinking, no, he was honoring his son, and he was even showing a proud father in the Middle East would have stayed and wait till his son came to him, you know. And but you know, he hiked up a sign of dishonor, but in a way to honor his son. And then the other brother was offended by that, you know. And you know, there's that great aspect of salvation was showing honor to him. It was he didn't say I forgive you. He put a ring on his
interesting, you know, on this actual finger. Not just a wiping out of debt, but an elevation and really emphasizing God's humility and being able to come down to our very interesting.
Yeah.
Very
and interesting. And then the other one that is more in the Southern Hemisphere, the African nations in particular, is between power and fear. So they experience the effects of sin are fear. And you know that you have all the black magic and the witchcraft and all that, which is surround, you know, that's the effects of sin for these cultures, and to be liberated from that is to be liberated from fear. And
interesting.
I have seen this. I was in my teens. We were in South Africa. I was driving south of Durban, and you could see out in the distance these green patches in a desolate, gray, you know, almost basically desert. You see these patches, these oases, this oasis of just green. And we asked the guy who was driving us, what's that? Is that, you know, some park? It's like, oh, those are Christians. That's a Christian farmer. And the what? Just, and we're like, yeah, exactly. Okay. We're like, well, what do you mean? That's a Christian. The Zulus were fearful of prosperity. They were fearful of being having more than their neighbor. That they're fearful. They were very superstitious, and it kept them. They were so a green, prospering farm was they were afraid they would be they would come under some curse. You know, they were living in fear, and it was affecting them directly. And Christians
so it's
were
kind of a liability to be prosperous.
Yeah, well, it has. They explained it in more detail, but how it's part of the Zulu culture where you're under a kind of curse if you are more prosperous than your neighbor, if you have too much, it's sort of a karma, luck type of thing, and so they're just afraid of it. These Christians are liberated from it, and they just without fear prosper. And you can see it from miles away. So there's, and we don't think about that. It's just at all, you know, there, we,
that's not how we process.
We do salvation. Have some of the guilt, the shame, honor. Mm-hmm. Teens know what that is. You know, the cool, as Nate Wilson, yes. you know, used the phrase cool shaming, you know, yeah. you know, there's aspects of that, but the fear, the power part is probably the most foreign to us. But this is a tangent to show, that you, it's difficult to understand that these are the tools of an evangelist to understand. You know, if you take American evangelism literature and you go to Africa or Europe or the Middle East, and you approach them with the things that would make an American think, you're understanding your culture and not theirs. So first, understand who you are. That gives the ability to understand from that perspective. That self-awareness, you know, Calvin starts his institutes
that's exactly what I was thinking.
Knowledge of God is knowledge of man and knowledge of man is knowledge of God. Mm-hmm. Knowledge of self is very important. So we have to,
you have to understand that you're coming from somewhere, that you are not this objective, point where you are completely neutral on every issue.
Right.
As a culture, we think through things in ways that are different than other people. Right. And that's okay.
Yeah. So to kind of sum it up a little bit, if you understand classical education as inherit the humanities and you start applying it, you guarantee it will be shocked at how Roman you are. And when I say you, I'm talking to American Christians in particular. And that can slightly change depending if, you know, other cultures that might be listening, but generally that's going to be particularly for Americans, but really Westerners and any, to a certain degree, every Christian, because this is the Christian inheritance. So what does a classical education look like for Chinese? Well, it's going to maybe look a little bit different, but there's going to be mostly overlap because of the Christian part. There may be aspects that you would add that Eastern texts, Confucius, perhaps, to understand, you know, your inheritance, where it's coming from, even the pagan authors, we read Aristotle and Plato, because they're part of that inheritance. They're part of the soil into which Christianity was born. Even understanding the heresies of the early church, you can't do that without understanding Platonism, the good and the bad, and these heresies keep coming back again. So it's understanding. There's so much of value to understanding, both in terms of truly plundering the Egyptians, as Augustine says, taking the good and avoiding the bad. It's a wonderful journey of realizing who you are and of coming into your inheritance.
Yeah.
And if you inherit some grand estate, there's probably some stuff to watch for that aren't good. Yeah. But I really love the idea of inheritance. Mm.
And this, that actually makes me think of the most people thinking of this metaphor of inheritance as education as inheritance. Mm-hmm. Most people don't come into their inheritance until they're an adult, say they're, you know, you're not of age yet. Mm-hmm. That makes me think of, as a Christian, you know, you can spend the first part of your, you know, your journey, your Christian life as just studying the Bible, just getting to know the Bible, incredibly worthwhile. That's the foundation of our whole worldview.
Right.
But as you get older and you start to get into these, you know, as you develop and become more mature, you should be getting into these questions of why do we believe these things? What, you know, right. we have these things outside the Bible, like the creeds and right. certain things that we know to be heresies. Why are those things heresies? Where did these creeds come from? These traditions right. of the church? We're in a particular place today, and every denomination of Christianity has come from somewhere. Every church that you go to has a history. And I believe that every Christian, it's every Christian's responsibility to, as they mature in their faith, to begin to understand the history of the church. The closing of the, if you never read anything except for the Bible, that's not bad. But as you try to understand and make sense of where we are today, where the church history has come from. That's something that I found incredibly helpful as I've gone through, particularly the Old Western Culture course.
Right.
You know,
right.
talking about the Greeks, how they prefigured, the Greeks and Romans, how they prefigured Christianity, how Christianity took over the Roman Empire, and how that developed through the Middle Ages, and then where we are today with our, culturally worldwide, we have a suspicion of, well, maybe not worldwide, but at least in the West, we have a suspicion of religion and faith and making sense of so much of that. That's one of the most valuable things that the Old Western Culture course has helped me understand. And that's, I think, in a lot of ways, that's the heart of the humanities approach to classical education. Is that
right? Yeah. So that's where I wanted to kind of go back to the focal point, you know, the center of history, you know, the incarnation of Christ.
Yes.
Because you can kind of go back and forward from that. Understanding that, then you understand a little from position, you go forward into history, like you said, the Middle Ages, and that's why the early church fathers loved these classics. Oh, that's why.
Even though they're pagans, the church fathers loved these writers.
Exactly. And then when, by the time you hit the founding of America or even the Enlightenment period, but especially the founding of America, it's, you have a handles for it. Otherwise, if you, it can be confusing to say, why did George Washington have a copy of Cicero's writings, or was it Livy? It was Livy or Cicero on his bedside alongside his Bible. Mm-hmm. You know, so you could say, well, he had that and I respect the founding fathers and therefore I should probably pay attention to classical education because they, in a very obvious way, appreciated it and felt that it was necessary for this American experiment and all that. But how much better to go back and understand what led up to it. And if you do it that way, if you start at the beginning, that's why we stop Old Western Culture where we do. That's a very common question. Why don't you do the modern period in Old Western Culture? It's not that it's not worthwhile, and we probably will do some sort of sequel that we can't quite call Old Western Culture because that term was, coined by C.S. Lewis to describe that period of time up into the Enlightenment where which is the foundation of the ideas held in common until recent times by every educated person, but it's a platform in a very practical sense, from a pedagogical sense, from a from an apologetic sense, from a worldview sense. You know, I could go on. It's a platform for understanding, studying, analyzing modern times, and then the days we're living in right now. You know, the one of the things that I've said about the Great Books education is I've compared it to training wheels. It's like, you don't want to, you get to train on old ideas that have been well established. You know, if you learn how to grapple with ideas that are old and well established and have their walls around them, you know, these training wheels, then it's like doing training for warfare with blanks instead of going straight into real bullets. What I think a lot of worldview training does is that it goes straight into today's issues and without that foundation, without that platform, and it's dangerous. It's dangerous. How many kids go to college and leave the faith? Part of that is that they're not standing on that foundation of knowing exactly who they are. They have not come into their inheritance. Inherit the humanities. What I think is probably the most helpful way to understand what classical education is.
Okay, interesting. Now, a couple of those things, we've been emphasizing this connection between the pagan authors of the West, and how important those authors, even though they're not Christian, how important they are to, Christianity.
Right.
I feel like there's some members of our audience who might hear, okay, George Washington had Cicero, either Cicero or Livy, because we can't remember which one, but I think I remember you saying Cicero.
Yeah.
But he had Cicero and the Bible on his nightstand side by side. Does that might feel a little sacrilegious Does that feel, I mean, clearly, so what would you say to someone who's like, what do you mean? And I think that sort of person who has that outlook might also say, well, why don't you read any of the works of the Bible? Because that's, in a lot of ways, the Bible is a significant gap in the old Western culture curriculum. We don't, we cover the time periods, right. You know, but we don't have any of the, you know, any of the intertestamental stuff or any of the New Testament writings. So some people I feel like might go, well, you have to read, and there are other great books courses who you do read books of the Bible. I think in Omnibus, you actually do read through the whole Bible
right. Over
the course of the 6 years. But that's not because the Bible is
less
important. How would you talk to that person?
So the first of all, the love of the classics, the fear of the love of the classics competing with the Bible is not a new fear.
Right.
It's been something that people that the Christians throughout history have loved them to an extent that they did fear that, and it is something to balance. So it's not something to just dismiss completely. Old Western culture separates it, and I think that is a valuable thing because I actually don't want to put it on the same level. I think it's dangerous to view one of the things that I've been seeing recently is the Bible being treated as literature. It's literature. Let's treat it just like literature. And I do see a major distinction. There is a canon of scripture. It does matter.
Yeah.
We can argue about which great books should be in a certain curriculum.
Yeah.
So I think that there's the scriptures, I would like to think that Washington had the Bible right by him and Cicero was behind it. I don't know. But
we'll fill in the gaps here.
The idea is that that these are that the scripture is assumed here. So I think it's some of our workbook actually mentions, you know, that they're, you know, as far as who's the audience for, we say this is, you know, we deal with some issues of paganism. It's kind of a content warning we have in our workbook saying this is, if you're reading the full work, this is intended for roughly ages 14 and up. And in that section, we say, you know, this is an assuming a Christian audience as well, meaning that for students of old Western culture, the tagline is a Christian approach to the great books.
Yeah.
We are assuming both a biblical literacy and a certain basics of the catechism these are catechized children. You know, not a specific catechism, but this is a historically Christian approach that presupposes biblically literate teens who are entering this. So I it's not put alongside the curriculum because I consider it built on top of that. That's an assumption we're building on.
Okay. So to those people who would be a little bit worried about this, it's implicit. And when you watch through the lectures, when you hear Wes talking obvious, about everything, very obvious that the Bible is assumed as the primary foundation for everything else, whole old Western culture course is secondary to the Bible. And
we're talking about old Western culture here, but this goes for all of our curriculum.
Oh, yes.
A lot of Christian curriculum will be Christian by adding Bible verses to the curriculum.
Right, just tacking it on.
We don't do that. We have a presuppositional Christianity.
That is, I think,
far more powerful. The first lecture of Old Western Culture actually discusses the idea of where we get truth. And there is a certain great books conversation where this synthesis of the ideas of the past bring you to truth that we reject. And Wes Callahan is talking about that in lecture one. You know, where do we get in truth as Christians? That comes from the revelation of God through scripture. And all of this, we are viewing all of this great conversation in light of scripture. We don't arrive at truth by, you know, it's an average of the great conversation or anything like that.
Right.
It's we're Christians first and foremost, and it is, we're basing it on on revelation, not on the source of truth.
Reason. Yeah, I think I remember that. I think I remember hearing that one of our textbooks, the author, when he was starting on it, he started writing this textbook by reading the whole Bible. That's
Rhetoric textbook. Yes. It's one of the appendixes is every speech in the Bible. We're basing it off of that. So one of the appendixes is it. The curriculum was written first by analyzing the entire Bible by going through it. So yes, that is, but we don't have the Bible verse for each lesson. You know, it is a difference. And I think
it's assumed a more mature.
The curriculum is very powerful. And I think there's sometimes a danger in copying the externals of what has been passed directly down to us. So not a well-established inheritance of the humanities, but simply this will affect some other aspects of pedagogy. But, you know, even the way we do grades, the way we do assessment, the way we do five days a week.
The norms of our day.
There are norms that we have, that Christians in the last 100 years or so in particular have accepted without thought. And we've tacked on Bible verses and said, now that's Christian curriculum, that's Christian education. But there are, curriculum is very powerful. The way we educate is there's often a didactic, a teaching element in the form that we accept and then call it Christian by tacking on a Bible verse. I think that it's much more important to really understand who we are, where we came from, why we do what we do, such that it's presuppositionally, that has other connotations as well, but that it is foundationally Christian and not just tacked on.
I see. So a pagan philosophy course with a Bible verse tacked on. So the approach is fundamentally non-Christian or even sometimes antithetical to Christianity, but we just tack on a little bit of, you know, a little post-it note on top.
Right. And the result is that I believe that as Christians thoughtfully create curriculum that's not just tacking on the Bible verse, we're going to have non-Christians saying, why are the Christian scientists making breakthroughs? Why are they, you know, they're going to start saying, they're going to start saying, we want that. And we're going to have to look, you know, I heard the author's a Christian. Oh, what a shame. It's the best one out there. You know, that's right now it's kind of the, you know, if you just look over the last 30 years, there are a lot of things that are Christian, whether it's the arts or, you know, music and or curriculum, it's often the not known for its excellence.
Right.
It's known for being a poorer copy of the world with the Bible verse on top.
Right. And often some, especially a course like a Christian worldview course, it is very Christian, sort of, but really fails to delve into the subjects themselves. Either it's a poorer version of the original pagan one with a Bible verse, or it is Christian and it basically says why you should hate all art or something like that. Why all art is, you know. So that's another camp that I've seen some kinds of Christians can go in that direction of not actually learning, not actually appreciating some of these things.
Right. It's an answer key, which ends up being legalism very easily.
Right.
The reason curriculums are legalistic is because if you say, here's what you're supposed to believe.
Right.
Then at one point kids are saying, why? That's the reaction to legalism.
Yeah. Which is something that I know I'm always bringing this back to the old Western culture course, but it's Wes does an amazing job of, he actually knows these works, the pagan and the Christian works. He actually loves and appreciates them. And you don't just listen to him to hear everything wrong with the immorality of the Greeks and everything wrong with the immorality of the Romans.
Right.
You know, you're actually delving into these works and understanding them for what they are and understanding them also from a Christian perspective.
Right. I've described it once as old Western culture is introducing a friend to a mutual friend. you know, now let's bring it in the terms of inheritance. It's a little bit like you know, that weird uncle who has so much to, you might bring your kids to say, hey, we're going to go see,
great uncle so-and-so.
Great uncle. And, maybe he's a war vet or something. There's so much to learn here. Listen to him, appreciate him. This is your inheritance, kids. Like, mm-hmm. he's going to tell you, ask him war stories, but you might say, but you know, I'd like to just, we're going to talk about it afterwards and beforehand. We don't agree with certain things. That's the right attitude to come at with these pagans. There's a lot of truly good things to glean from Plato.
Absolutely.
And yet it also wreaked havoc with certain heresies in the church throughout history. And even to today, some of the Platonic heresies we're still struggling with. Mm. So you don't want to approach it as something where you're just up and guarding and saying everything wrong with it. You want both, mm-hmm. and you have to have both to really build on it and learn from it and not fall into either ditch of extremism, rejecting it all and therefore not even understanding who you are, or accepting it blindly or just the whole thing. So yeah, it takes wisdom, which is where mm-hmm. that's where I'll give that's why I like Circe's definition of classical education, the cultivation of wisdom and virtue. Wisdom is essential here. But I think the idea of inheriting is a helpful way to understand the how as well as the what.
Mm. There's a lot there. There's a lot there. And if you're interested in learning more about Old Western culture and what it means to inherit the humanities, this tradition that you can inherit, in a future episode, I think maybe the next episode, but in a future episode of this podcast, we're going to be sharing the full lecture from the inaugural lecture of Old Western culture. So you'll be able to.
I referenced it today. So yeah.
Yes. So go find that episode and give that a listen if you're interested in that. Thank you for listening to the Digressio podcast. Until next time, read your Bible, read a good book, and keep inheriting the humanities.
Amen.